Well, this planet is going through incredible changes, regardless of how or why, but it is. In a moment, Peter Ward joins us live from way out in the United Kingdom area as we talk with him about what's happening with the planet, how much is it changing, and how does that affect us? More with Peter Ward on Coast to Coast AM. I'll tell you about our next guest. Dr. Peter Ward has been active in paleontology, biology, astrobiology. He has published more than 140 scientific papers on these particular fields. Currently, he conducts research within the Environmental Institute's Sprigg Geobiology Center. He is an acknowledged world expert on mass extinctions and the role of extraterrestrial impacts like asteroids on Earth. Ward was the principal investigator of the University of Washington node of the NASA Astrobiology Institute. That was back in 2001, and he led a team of more than 40 scientists and students. The planet, as I mentioned, is going through amazing change these days. Here comes Peter Ward. Peter, welcome back.
Well, thank you so much. It's been too long, and we are bouncing this off a satellite as I am in Australia doing this.
Oh, you're over there.
Afternoon, by the way.
You are down under now, huh?
Yeah, it's a major change. I lived in gray Seattle, Washington, and gee, you know, that beautiful sunshine that comes out every day here, it's quite a surprise.
It really is. Peter, let me check to see if there's any lag time just so I know where we are so I don't step on you when we're talking. So, I'll count to three, and then you can just say yes, say hello right after that. One, two, three.
Hello.
Okay, just a little tiny lag, so I'll know when to pause, just so we don't have any issues with you when you talk. What have you been doing lately? I mean, when we talked, it was almost 2 years ago, year and a half ago.
Well, I moved to Australia, and actually I've been doing kind of a new career gig for me. I've started doing deep water photography. Video of deep water reefs, and we were looking at waters from 400 to 2,000 feet deep. We put down baited traps. We leave down on these baited traps video cameras for up to 20 hours, and then we look to see what is there. And part of this is trying to understand what is going on in the oceans, because as you mentioned, our oceans are going through not just big-time chemical and physical changes, there's major biological changes going on, and the things we're seeing are pretty incredible.
How long have you been down under these days, Peter?
This is my fourth month, so I'm a brand-new down-under person. It's still very exciting.
What are they saying about the Malaysia 370 plane?
Well, you know, Australia was really the lead in trying to go get it. I think it's really showing us, we think our technology is so special and so good, and we're just beginning to understand really how big that ocean really is. The sense that something really extraordinary happened on that plane is palpable here. People want to think that something just normal happened, but I think what really is coming home is how difficult, I mean, how impossible it's going to be to find it now. I don't think we have a chance. That's a huge ocean.
It is. I mean, we've come up with all kinds of guest theories here, Peter, that it's on land somewhere. So it was hijacked. The pilots may have done it. The latest theory, of course, is that the pilots may have blacked out in the plane on autopilot, just flew until it ran out of fuel and down it went. But I think you're right. We may never know what happened to it.
I've heard the theory about the blackout, and as I heard that, I was horrified because just because the pilots are blacked out doesn't mean these poor passengers were. I mean, you may have just had people screaming back there. Just the whole sense of it is just so horrific.
Ugh. You know, I fly a lot. I must take 35 flights a year now. And, you know, the worst I've ever had to date are, you know, some bumps. I couldn't imagine being on a plane, knowing that there's something wrong in the cockpit, you know, and you can't get in. And you're just stuck there. What a horrible feeling.
Well, the other horrible feeling, too, and I don't even know if I should go here, but again, what we do is we put down these baited traps. And there's a lot of people down there in that plane. And I understand exactly what deep ocean scavenging is like. And this is as far as I need to say that.
But understand.
I have a really good idea.
Yeah. Let's talk a little bit some of the work that you've done with impacts on good old planet Earth and really planet killers at the time. Peter, is it safe to say that it's just not a matter of if, but a matter of when this planet is going to get hit and get hit with a big one? I mean, we saw what happened a few years ago in Russia with a meteorite. I mean, it's going to happen, isn't it?
Oh, you're absolutely right. And that the whole Russian episode was fascinating, wasn't it? Not just from the fact that finally we get the realization, oh, gee, those scientists keep saying we're going to get hit. In fact, we got hit. But the little ones like that, you can't see them coming. And yet the destruction, just something a tiny bit larger. We go back to that Tunguska effect. I think that was in 1913, where a pretty big one hit. The nightmare scenario for we who study it is that one of these things we call an airburst, where it's not large enough to all the way hit the ground. If it's 50 meters or less, the compression of the air as the big rock comes crashing down explodes. But it mimics an atomic explosion. Now, what happens if we have one of these airbursts right over Manhattan? You would have 1 million people dead. You've got a president trying to figure out, did we just have a terrorist explosion? Is this an atomic attack? Exactly. What do I do?
Yeah, that's a good point. Tunguska, 1908, so you're close there, and it just flattened thousands and thousands and thousands of acres of trees and everything else. I think there might have been one or two fatalities, thank God. But you're right. If something like that were to explode over a really inhabited area, those people are gone. Now, how do they die? From the concussion? What kills them?
Yeah, the concussion does it. But we also have learned a great deal about what killed the dinosaurs. There is an airburst, but there's also a pressure wave and then a heat shock wave. And you're going to get very close in. People would get incinerated. The lack of radiation would tell national security that this was not indeed an atomic attack. But here's the frustrating part. A number of us who studied these things back, I guess it was 10 years ago now, tried to put feelers out to the then White House saying, is there anybody, do you have a single phone number that those of us who understand this and could recognize this for what it being, that we could call and give you a heads up? Do you have anybody you can call, your national security science advisor, to tell you this was not an atomic attack? They wouldn't listen to us. They just, ha, ha, ha.
That's not a good thing. Now, to date, Peter, what do you see as this planet's biggest potential catastrophe? An asteroid? An X-flare from the sun that wipes out the grid? What do you see as the biggest issue?
Well, there's the issues that could really take out an awful lot of people. And the big issue, I think, that we haven't really thought about are gamma ray bursts. These are entirely galactic crossing energetic bursts of high radiation that's coming at you. And we know these things come as beams. They would mainly come from a galactic center. And if you really wanted to wipe out a planet, this would be the quickest and the nastiest way. But I'm telling you, my scariest scenario right now is short-term nuclear exchange in Asia. And I think we have a very good, reasonable possibility of this happening in the next 50 years, simply because of sea level rise and the fact that sea level rise is going to be covering up a lot of the rice crops. And you've got India and Pakistan who hate each other already, who are already nuclear armed.
So you think a war over shortages of natural resources and food?
Yep, and I really am quite afraid. I've been working in the Philippines for the last, 4 years. Our deep water fishing, looking for fish in the Philippines, there's nothing left in the Philippine oceans. I mean, they've eaten virtually every fish in the ocean. It's the only place I can dive where I never look over my shoulder for sharks because they're all gone.
Huh.
But what's also going on, is that the Spratly Islands, these are a small set of islands that are in Philippine territory, have been taken over by China. And we saw in the last year that the Chinese trying to impose air restrictions and that the U.S. then quickly flew its bombers over. But the Spratlys are oil rich, but they're fish rich. And there is close to a war already between the Filipinos and the Chinese. Well, we know which way that would go very quickly. But look, I live in Australia. The Australians are arming themselves quickly. They are buying U.S. Jets They are really worried. Everybody in this neck of the woods is very afraid of China.
Now, in terms of the residents of Australia, they can't possess firearms, can they? Can they not?
To my knowledge, they don't. And this is it's a very different field in this society, because it is, there have been some horrific firearm accidents and just all-out massacres, as there have been in the U.S., but far fewer. But nevertheless, you've got just north of Australia, you've got Java, Indonesia, you've got this enormous mass of Asian populations who look south to Australia and see this very unpopulated, very rich continent. So, of course, there's tremendous number of boat people who keep landing on Australian shores. So Australia has a gigantic coastline. It's very, very difficult to patrol that coastline. So this is, it's very equivalent to the southern U.S. border, where it was before the U.S. economy tanked, we'd have that problem.
Do you have that many people flooding into Australia?
Absolutely. Boat people are coming from Indonesia every single day. It's right across the Torres Straits. It's just Indonesia is a very crowded place. And just as in the Philippines, you've got mountainous terrain. Every square acre that can be farmed is being farmed. Now, let's take the next 100 years of sea level rise, as well as increasing that population by 50 to 100%. And the math just does not work out.
Yeah, let's talk about the sea level rise for a moment, Peter, because this is going to happen. I mean, there's not much we can do to stop this, I don't think. How high does the sea level have to rise before it begins to inundate coastal regions like New York, like Florida, areas like that?
Well, there's a couple of issues, and it's not very simple. There are three aspects to it. First of all, it's just the absolute rise itself. The sea is rising, covers up the land. That's the simplest. But as we saw in the recent storms, there's something called storm surge, where if you even have a 2-foot sea level rise, that doesn't seem like much. But for that next storm that comes pouncing on you, salt water is pushed way farther inland. And it's really a sad fact that a huge proportion of human agriculture is in low-lying areas. Rice production takes place in the deltas. The scariest fact of all is that the South Chinese coast, as well as the East Coast of the U.S., are two places where sea level rise would be the most severe. It's not symmetrical. It is different continents at different levels. And of course, I mean, just bad luck of this world is that one of the most populated places, China, is going to have massive sea level rise.
Sooner than later?
That's a 24,000-36,000 year question. How soon is it going to happen? And we know we're going to have 3 to 4 feet minimum by 2100, because the expansion of the oceans, just the water's getting warmer, heat makes things expand.
Yeah.
But as you saw on my birthday, on May 12th of this year, the big report came out about the Antarctic ice sheet and that it was disintegrating. This was done from years of satellite imagery, but the reports came out on the 12th, the 13th, the 14th of May. And this is going to add 10 feet to sea level rise. The whole question is, how soon do you add that 10 feet? But even 3 feet is disastrous. You fly a lot. You said you fly. How many airports do you land on are built out into bays or next to the ocean?
There's some.
Or a 3-foot sea? Yeah, San Francisco, Sydney, Honolulu, and many in Japan. There are just so many airports. They're going to have to move them. That costs money, lots and lots and lots of money.
And we have seen historical stories of ancient cities that are deep underwater. So how far out did they go? I mean, were they connected to the same landmass that we have now, let's say? And how deep under are they, Peter? Because they obviously have never popped back up again.
Well, there's an awful lot of flooding that happened since the last ice age. Look, if we'd had cities 12,000 years ago, and why not? The sea level since then has gone up 300 or 400 feet. So you could go down 300 feet, which is the limit of scuba diving, and you could very well run into, whoops, there's that 14,000-year-old city.
An entire city. How did it rise so high?
Well, we used to have ice everywhere, and that ice itself, because it takes so much ocean water to form ice, the glaciers that we had 12, 13,000 years ago had sucked up so much of the sea. They dropped the level way, way down. With the melting of that, which began about, say, 15, 14, 12,000 years ago and finished about 10,000 years ago, sea level rose. And it rose quite a bit. 130 meters is pretty much what the estimate is. But the problem is we've got a lot more ice to melt than just Antarctica. So let's just say we melt everything in Antarctica. We have 70 meters or 240 more feet that it can go up. If you look at the 240-foot mark in New York, you're going to find there's not a lot of New York City left. I did this calculation for Seattle. The Space Needle is sitting out of the water, sitting all by itself. And then you've got these little hills that are just now islands. And, of course, Miami, Galveston, much of the Bay Area, these places are long gone.
If I can get supernatural for a moment, the late prophet Edgar Cayce, in a trance state, basically dreamed what North America would look like in the future. And because of the erosion of the coastal lines and everything else, it is amazing, Peter. I don't know if you've ever seen that map, but, I mean, there is massive devastation with the erosion and the increase of sea levels and water levels.
Well, sea level rise is a terrible thing, and we talked about the actual rise and storm, but there's a third aspect. Salt water goes sideways. Yes, say you have a foot rise in sea level, you might have hundreds and hundreds of lateral feet of salt moving into soil that can no longer grow crops.
Good point.
This is my fear. I mean, this is the horrible part, is the salinization of places like Bangladesh. Bangladesh feeds itself. With a 3-foot sea level rise, Bangladesh can't feed itself because 40% of it is underwater.
Does the water ever evaporate to the point where it just goes out into space?
Yeah, actually, the oceans have been slowly leaving our planet over time. There's a calculation that, in fact, about 2 billion years from now, we are going to start losing our oceans to space at a very rapid rate. About the last half of the life of planet Earth, we will be an oceanless planet. We have pretty good calculations that the age of animals, which is a 500 million years in length, is halfway over. I mean, we are halfway through us being able to be animals in an oxygen atmosphere.
Why aren't we losing ocean now? It seems to be getting higher, not lower.
Well, we're losing it, but even the Apollo astronauts, my great colleague Don Brownlee pointed this out, that you can see it in cameras coming back from the moon. The Apollo astronauts were able to photograph the ocean's slowly being lost to space. But again, we've got so much locked into ice. We've got a long time. But the sun, as you know, gets hotter and hotter every year. And as it gets hotter, the temperature of the planet is going up. And this is really going to cause the eventual loss of the oceans.
And well, I've always said that a lot of this global warming, climate change, is based on a hotter sun.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, we are one-third hotter since the formation of the Earth. And it's just, astronomers know this. This is just a straight line. And the other aspect, too, as you know, is that we have been astronomers not long enough to really understand the frequency of solar flares and solar activity. We are just brand new looking at the sun. We need some thousands of years to better understand what it has done in the past.
Stay with us, Peter. We're going to take this quick break. Then we're going to come right back and talk more about a changing planet. I'm George Norrie, back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. Peter Ward with us as he is way down under today, as he's been for the last several months. Peter, I've got to ask you this, too. Craig Venter, who, you know, was one of those who sequenced the Genome Project, you call him one of the most dangerous men on the planet. How come?
No, I called him the most dangerous man on the planet.
Not one of.
Just, I was able to question him in 2008 at a TED conference because he was touting his ability to produce the first alien on Earth. Now, as you know, we're made up of a lot of different chemicals, but the prime makeup of a protein is called an amino acid. All Earth life is made up of 20 specific amino acids. One of the really cool questions, George, why those 20? But that aside, Craig figured out a way to make a microorganism that has a 21st amino acid. Oh. It is truly an alien. Now, I questioned him. I said, well, what if we had a 21st amino acid creature? Maybe our immune system wouldn't be able to fight it. Maybe it would be able to be such an alien weapon. He laughed at me in front of 500 people. He said, oh, we would be able to produce a defense so quickly there wouldn't be much loss. Yeah, right. I still love football, where a good offense overwhelms a defense pretty quickly.
So he kind of like pushed it off like no big deal.
Exactly. Look, after the atomic weapons were built, the entire world recognized how dangerous they were, and they were taken away. They were taken away from just the common person is not going to have plutonium. I mean, it's just way too dangerous. We now have the equivalent of atomic weapons in biology. And what scares me is that we can produce maybe 100 atomic-level physicists per year. It's really hard to be a nuclear physicist. Biology departments I've been part of, we can produce up to 1,000 people a year, every single university, that have the gene techniques that can produce weaponized diseases. We are really playing with the stuff of Foundation, and we are playing God. Craig was asked, you act like you're God. He answered, yes, I am God.
He may be dangerous. Jeez.
Yes, indeed.
Well, I'm concerned too, Peter, that science is going to continue to dabble with changing Mother Nature. We've seen what they've done with genetically modified foods and seeds. You know what? I think they're going to continue doing that with people too.
Very well could be. Look, it's just the Frankenstein myth runs so deeply in our culture, and it's there in a new guise every year, but it is because it's a serious issue. Science has unleashed such wonders, and yet if you really want to wipe us out, it's science that's going to do it. I mean, the issue you bring, genetically modified crops, is such a difficult one morally and ethically, and yet at the same time, we know we have a runaway population boom on this planet, that since you and I were born, the population is more than doubled, and then it's still going up. So how are we going to feed everybody in the face of sea level going up even a little bit?
Yeah.
Maybe one of the ways to do it is genetically modified organisms. And yet the biggest danger of those, as you know, is that genes can escape. Let's say that you make this beautiful, beautiful corn plant that is resistant to pesticides. And so you can bomb the cornfield, all the nasty bugs everywhere, everything just gets killed. And then that pesticide resistance jumps from the plant to a bug. I mean, this is what's scary, is that we are producing things that can escape.
Exactly. Is there any control over this, Peter?
Well, that's the same question with Craig Venter, is that we are not producing commissions. We don't have high-level groups of really deeply moral people who are questioning the effects now of the biological engineering that's taking place. The discussions that took place in the 1945-46, after nuclear weapons were on the table, were discussions that were made at such a high level by very, very serious people. Are we having similar types of people sitting down and saying, you know, there's some things that we should not mess with because of the danger to our population? I don't think so.
As a paleontologist, do you think it's conceivable that there still is an ancient dinosaur somewhere on the planet, a pterodactyl, a plesiosaur, something?
I wish. I don't think so, simply because what we see, those are big animals, and big animals generally need at least a few hundred of themselves to be able to have a breeding stock. I mean, it's just not a case of you can't just have two, because
they'll die.
We've seen
off.
Cases yeah. where they will die off, and also not just die off, but the inbreeding that takes place. I have my beautiful dog is a Cavalier St. Charles. They're a little spaniel, except most Cavaliers get heart disease and die by 5 years old.
Oh, my God.
The breed went down to a handful at the end of World War II in England, and then the several that survived, because the poor British were so poor, several of them had genetic failures of hearts that they passed on. And so now every one of these things. So this is what would happen to a group of plesiosaurs in Loch Ness. Sooner or later, if you're at such low population number, some genetic abnormality is going to creep in. It's going to kill you off.
So we have a lot of things we need to be concerned about, in addition to mankind screwing things up.
Oh, absolutely. I really think one of the fascinating things to look at now is what's going on in the oceans. Evolution never stops. Humans are evolving. All animals and plants are evolving. It never stops. If that's the case, then we know that evolution has produced so many different types of morphologies and creatures and plants. Do we think that's over? Heck no. One of the things that we find fascinating in our deep water photography, and I'm doing videos and movies of 1,000-foot bottoms on the various types of creatures that come waltzing up. Many of these are new to science. I think the chemistry change that we are doing to the oceans today is unleashing an unbelievable variety of new species out there, and we're just starting to see these.
Well, let's look at some of these other issues then, Peter, that face mankind that could be out there. What's next?
Well, we know what's next taking place right now in the oceans is that we need a lot of seafood to survive, but that an awful lot of ocean fishery stocks are dropping in number. We know that. I mean, we just understand that an awful lot of the fishery stocks we thought were limitless aren't. But, George, you've noticed that there's been some really strange things going on in the oceans. I'm sure you've read about the jellyfish. Huge mass population blooms. One of these hit England, another was up near Iceland. But out of seemingly nowhere, unbelievable numbers of jellyfish have been increasing in the oceans. Jellyfish are a really primitive life form. They were the second type of animal to have ever evolved following sponges. Huh. All jellyfish are carnivores. All jellyfish are carnivores. There's just no happy plant jellyfish. They all eat meat, and many of them eat fish. The Portuguese man of war with those powerful toxins. And we have jellyfish, the box jellyfish in Australia, that will kill you really fast. Increasing the number of jellyfish is going to be, I think, eventually a huge global threat to swimmers everywhere. They're not just going to be confined to Australia. As it is now, over 5 months, there are beaches, huge coastlines in Australia. No one dares go in the water. You've got two types of completely fatal stings. Jeez. You can't see it coming. So this is major ocean change taking place.
Once they sting you, Peter, do they try to eat you?
They're pretty stupid. They don't have much in the way. They don't know. Certainly when they sting the fish, they certainly eat those. Whether they could eat a human or not, I don't think so. But these things don't know. This is an automatic little stinger. It has to touch flesh, and it has to detect through a chemical means, it is flesh, and it fires a little harpoon. Each tentacle has thousands to tens of thousands of these things. They are poison-tipped. And so you get hit many, 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 many times. The thing is that the really toxic ones, you only have to be hit once.
Do these harpoons stay attached to the jellyfish, or do they shoot out?
They shoot out. They have a little bitty thread, and there's more of them in the stomach. So what the jellyfish does and what... Oh, yeah. They reel you in and then dissolve you.
It's like a taser.
Oh, absolutely. It's just exactly the police taser. They fire it into you. They've got this thing, there's poison on the tip, and they've got you.
And then they reel you in.
And they reel you in.
Well, you got to be careful. You know what? So it's not just sharks you got to worry about.
Oh, no. In Australia, at the Great Barrier Reef, there are... People are now wearing complete suits covering. As the water's warm, you're not wearing a wetsuit for the warmth. You're wearing a nylon suit to make sure that no bit of your skin is exposed.
Wow.
And because these things are so toxic.
And you're getting a hit and attacked by these deliberately. It's not like you brushed your leg across a piece of coral, for example.
Oh, no. They're out there. They're looking for flesh. And they're looking. They are fish eaters. And so we have the same taste as a fish. They don't know. They're stupid.
They don't know.
But the point being, with these gigantic increases in jellyfish, we are seeing an ocean out of balance. And if we increase the number, and why wouldn't we, of the very toxic jellyfish, you're going to see a really different swimming scenario here over the next coming decade.
Why are we getting so many jellyfish? What's happening in the oceans to create that?
That's the $64,000 question, George, and no one knows. I think the major change that has taken place, you can't just blame it on warming, but carbon dioxide goes and dissolves in water, and it makes it slightly more acidic. The oceans are getting more acid. It's just enough to change the balance of what is going on chemically. Some creatures not doing very well. Those that produce calcium carbonate shells are dissolving away. But jellyfish, for who knows what reason, are loving the acid oceans. And so you are getting this change in the dominance of the carnivores.
That's kind of scary, Peter.
Yeah, it is. Believe me, my Australian colleagues, you just go up north, any of those cities, Broome, you head up, and on the coast, you've got big signs. You don't go in the water.
You have looked at the situation of Fukushima when that happened. What's happening to our fish, albeit we have a shortage, of, you know, being radiated, contaminated, high mercury levels? What's going on there?
Well, again, the fish are just eating down the food chain, and it's the small, tiny organisms that pick up this stuff. So the fish themselves are getting very high level of toxins. It's not just Fukushima. That's the extreme case that we all worry about. We see this ancient 1950s, 1960s level design nuclear reactor that is based on really outmoded technology, and it was put in the worst possible place. I mean, we see this. But even when I lived in Seattle, Washington, people can't eat the bottom fish there anymore because of years and years and years of pulp mills. A great deal of mercury was released into the environment. It settles in the mud. The bottom fish eat fish that eat the mud, and you've got very toxic fish virtually everywhere.
Do you eat shrimp, for example?
Actually, I eat the shrimp I catch because we have, when we put these deep, deep traps down, there are enormous quantities of shrimp down there, and we catch them. But I don't eat shrimp coming out of the gigantic Asian big ponds that they're building. I don't want to go graphically to your listeners, but those are dubious enterprises, the food farmed shrimp taking place in some of the Asian countries.
So when you go to a restaurant here in the States, for example, would they know where they're getting their seafood from, or is it just some supplier, you know, here in LA, for example?
Good restaurants will always know. And many of the restaurants, seafood restaurants, are now very, very conscious of, should we even be feeding anybody this? For instance, the old Chilean sea bass, they called it.
I remember
it's,
that.
Actually,
yeah.
It's a toothfish, and it's a very small population that has subsequently been fished almost to extinction. A good seafood restaurant would never serve that anymore. Secondly, if you eat swordfish, you better not eat it more than once a month because of the mercury content, and good restaurants will know that too. But they also know for crustaceans, you really have to watch where your crustaceans come from because they are creatures that are eating mud and small creatures in the mud. So they're taking up toxins. And this is where, again, I'm just staying away from shrimp coming out of Asian, those big, cheap ponds.
What
about food for saying this?
No, not at all. What about the Gulf of Mexico?
Gulf of Mexico is still, I think, a very viable and a very great place. The shrimp there, this is a gigantic area. The sad thing, of course, is we had the oil spill.
Yeah.
And what has been the effect of that on those populations? We don't know yet. Gulf shrimp are great shrimp, but the fish farmed shrimp, and I'm sure there's great fish farms places where it's fine. But there are areas in Vietnam we know of. There are some Chinese areas that you just have a great deal of toxic material near these. And what kind of food are they feeding them?
And is the problem, Peter, we're just taking out too much fish before they have a chance to reproduce?
Yeah, absolutely. What really drives me crazy, George, is every once in a while in USA Today or some newspaper, you'll see some person who's caught a record giant fish. The big fish actually produce so much more than the little fish do. the fisheries that should take place now actually is that eat more of the smaller fish, but leave the big fish alone. They just are better at reproducing. It's so hard to regulate a fishery until it crashes. You know, we think it's fine, it's fine, it's fine. And look what happened along the West Coast at Monterey, Cannery Bay. That never came back.
Well, how do we escape all this, Peter? We're stuck.
We're not stuck. We're smart. And see, this is the other thing is once you get helpless, you go inactive. I personally, this is, again, where it gets scary. I think we have the tools with biology, and we talked about the Craig Venter scenarios and the awful things. I still think we have the ability to take areas. If we know that the sea is rising, and we know there's going to be many, many areas that become salty that aren't now, shouldn't we be trying to breed plants that can live in higher salt? I'm urging my university, the University of Adelaide, to think about rice and try to grow rice, try to genetically engineer rice that can live in a high salt content because it's coming. Wouldn't it be nice, George, you've seen mangrove swamps, these terrible trees that grow along hot tropical coastlines.
Right.
There's no food for a mangrove. Why couldn't we engineer mangroves that could grow pineapples on their top that allow us to have a plant which now takes up space and does nothing to produce food at the same time? I think this is where the gift of science can really help save us. But again, it's a double-edged sword, as you well know.
So you're in favor of doing some manipulation to plants?
Yeah, I think so. Yep. And I think it's just this becomes real politics. I'm also in favor of nuclear power plants that are reinvented, that are re-engineered, and are placed only in the most stable geological platforms. I don't see a way out of our energy needs with 7 billion people unless we can have at least some nuclear. George, I was thrown off a Scholastic radio program for saying that I favor some form of genetic modified crops. I mean, that's just politically incorrect, as is nuclear power. But I think in this day and age, let's be real. I mean, what do you want, starvation, or do you want people to have food and energy? We have to make hard decisions.
Well, we'll never throw you off, Peter. Not to worry about that. Peter,
you got to have a whole turn.
Peter's an accomplished author, by the way, the Medea Hypothesis. That's what we talked about when he was with me almost a year and a half ago. Under a Green Sky is another one, and then Rare Earth as well. We're going to come back in a moment with Peter. And we're going to work on his field, too, as an astrobiologist. What's going on out there in space, on Mars, Saturn's moon Titan? How about Jupiter's Europa? All that and much more on Coast to Coast AM.